But this time, the people of Iran are in the streets. The people of Iran are not backing down. The people of Iran are very, very clear with their political message, which is death to Khamenei, death to dictatorship. And these are critical indicators for us to pay attention to determine why it's different this time.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Backstory. I'm Dana Lewis. This week, for a change, we put Ukraine on the back burner, even though what's happening there is moving fast and in perilous ways. But I want to talk about Iran again. Starting in Kurdistan province, but quickly spreading nationwide, the protests have increased in size, scope, and sophistication. The regime has responded brutally, but the religious leaders of Iran also seem paralyzed by the demonstrations. Even this week, a female Iranian climber who competed in an international tournament without a hijab did so because her headscarf had dropped by mistake, she said on her Instagram account. Footage of Elnaz Rakabi, 33 years old, scaling a wall without her head covered during an international tournament went viral, coming amid big female-led demonstrations against Iran's clerical rulers, sparked by strict Islamic rules on women's clothing. In a moment, we speak to Ramesh Separad and ask, will these protests bring about the downfall of the Ayatollah and his regime in Iran? And you forgot about it, but the pandemic didn't forget about you. COVID-19 is spreading again. New variants known as BQ1 and BQ11 are rapidly taking over other variants, filling hospital beds. And as Dr. Eric Fagelding will tell you, they are escape variants, meaning they will not be taken down by a vaccine unless they are the very latest of boosters, unavailable, by the way, in most countries. Dr. Ramesh Separad joins me from Washington. She's a scholar in peace and conflict, and she's the advisory chair of the largest Iranian-American organization. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
There's a new wave of anti-regime protests sparked over the brutal killing of Mahsa Amini. And some of the numbers now say that it's reached 170 cities. More than 400 protesters have been killed and nearly 20,000 arrested. Those are all estimates. And neither you nor I are in Iran, so it's hard to know exactly what's going on the street. But how would you assess the tempo and the ferocity of the street protests now calling for regime change?
So I think we have to kind of look at these latest waves of protests, which in fact the chants from inside Iran are saying these are not protests, this is a revolution, has some very significant characteristic, whether you look at it from a just an average citizen's perspective or a political scientist perspective. And I think that's it's really an opportunity for us to pause and think about where the people of Iran are going with their message. One of the main characteristics is, obviously, even though that these protests, which is now within its fifth week, started over the brutal killing of Mahsa Amini in custody, the way the society responded to that news is demonstrative of how explosive the Iranian society has been. Because there has been killing in the last 43 years. There was the killing of Neda Agha Sultan. There was the killing of several other protesters, and in fact, 1,500 protesters in 2019. But this time, the people of Iran are in the streets. The people of Iran are not backing down. The people of Iran are very, very clear with their political message, which is death to Khamenei, death to dictatorship. And these are critical indicators for us to pay attention to determine why it's different this time. I think it's very, very clear that the Iranian people, especially the younger generation, the Gen Zers, are saying that we want this regime gone. We want the end of Khamenei's dictatorship. And what we want is freedom. Another popular chant in Iran is freedom, freedom, freedom. In fact, the chant is, what do we say? And then the crowd always responds, freedom, freedom, freedom. So there is a clear statement of what the problem is, which is Khamenei's dictatorship, and what the solution is, and that is the freedom. So whether we want to really look at it from a statistics perspective of how many people have been arrested or killed, or from the message that's coming from Iran, the overall perspective of where the protests and the uprising and what the Iranian people are calling revolution is leading is to the downfall of the regime and the freedom that the Iranian people desire.
Okay, that's the desire. But that's, I mean, right. It's important to pay attention to the arrests and those detained and those killed, because it shows whether the security services are controlling the street and continue to do so, right? So in a speech on Friday, Ayatollah Khamenei said that the Islamic Revolution had given birth to an unshakable state. That seedling has turned today into a mighty tree, and no one should dare to think that they can uproot it. I mean, he does not seem shaken or stirred, and seems to feel that these demonstrations will just go away.
Well, of course he would. As any other dictator, if you look at the throughout the history, any dictator, including people like Hitler, until the very last day, they were still confident and they were still conveyed this message of not being shaken. But when you think about the recent, the Friday evening's attack leading into the Saturday morning in Iran's time against the notorious Evin prison, which was a regime instigated attack, and it was their plot to massacre political prisoners. The very people that were arrested in recent uprising are also in Evin prison.
I want to let you finish, but I mean, that prison is notable, right? Because that's where it is supposedly one of the most brutal places that you can be sent. And it generally is where the fiercest political opposition is sent.
Right.
Political prisoners are sent to that prison, and often some of them don't come out.
That's right. I mean, this is a prison that has been notorious for more than two regimes, I must say. It was notorious during the Pahlavi's era under the Shah, with the political prisoners being tortured and executed there, as well as obviously the elevation of the number of executions and tortures under the current regime, the theocracy of mullahs. So these attacks on Evin prison is a clear indication of how frightened the regime is, because this is, even though they're trying to kind of portray it as a, or their official narrative is, oh, there was a fire that broke out, there was some conflict or clashes among the prisoners. Well, if that were the truth, then explain the gunshots, then explain the families that are outside the prison that are chanting death to Khamenei, explain the protester, the prisoners inside the prison chanting death to dictatorship, death to Khamenei. So clearly, this is a major indication of how frightened Khamenei is, and his rhetoric on Friday was literally designed to give his demoralized Basiji or IRGC thugs and motivate them to go back out there and kill more people. So I think there are other reports coming from Iran that the incident at Evin prison is also being repeated across the other main prisons in other cities in Iran. Just this morning, I think I had a message that now it is in the city of Karaj. The inmate at Ghazal Hisar prison are protesting with chants to death to Khamenei, and 50 members of the anti-riot unit are at the scene in prison. And again, this is, knowing this regime, I think the regime is preparing for another massacre of political prisoners, just as what they did in 1988. And obviously, they're afraid of what's happening in the streets of Iran during the protests across. In fact, the number of cities has gone up to 190 cities and towns in Iran. And now they want to really massacre the political prisoners. And this is their way of solving their problem. But the fact is that the people of Iran are not backing down. The resistance inside the prison clearly demonstrate that this regime is not even effective inside the prison with the people that they have in custody.
Can you talk to the state? You mentioned the Revolutionary Guards. Can you talk to the staying power of, you know, I mean, this is Khomeini's muscle, right? Khomeini's muscle. Their power, their wealth, their survival depends on the survival of the system. They are brutal. They have killed many Iranians in the past and are prepared to do anything. There is nothing that I understand indicates any of that buckling. I mean, there are no defections as far as we're hearing, and I understand it's hard to hear if there were, but there are no defections. I mean, they are standing like a rock right now in the system, and how do people remove them in order to remove the regime, because the regime stands behind the Revolutionary Guards?
Well, I think the message and what I'm monitoring coming from inside Iran, Dana, it's speaking to a different posture of IRGC. I have seen reports coming from inside Iran and clips and even audio recording between the dispatch of the IRGC forces as they're trying to crush and crack down on the people. And they're all desperate. They are is a sign of desperation, fatigue, exhaustion, and very demoralized. I think one of the lead IRGC commanders in Tehran was saying that you know, if this neighborhood of Tehran rises up, we will be finished. We will be done. So and I think they realize that obviously Tehran is their stronghold. They realize that they can't be dispatching IRGC and their core, committed IRGC, because, you know, there are layers within IRGC. Those are in there for just a paycheck. Those are in there that are in the more of a administrative and management of it. And those are in there that are very core ideologues that are, protectors of Khamenei's dictatorship. So we are seeing crackdown within the IRGC. We are seeing a defection, not from the top layer, which is not that many of them, but also from the lower layers. And I think the other
What are you based that on? If I can just ask, you're saying you're seeing defections. Is that what's that based on?
So some of the news that's coming from inside Iran is how they're moving their money around, how they're trying to buy properties in countries like Turkey and other countries, so that they're trying to get their families out of Iran, and how they're essentially turning on each other. There's a lot of debate within IRGC that is the path of crackdown the right path for us, because the more we crack down, the more uprising it causes. So I think that fraction within the IRGC ranks and the political ranks, Lari Johnny is on record, who used to be the beloved, you know, Lari Johnny brothers, allies of Khamenei. And he's also the person who was eliminated in favor of Ebrahim Raisi to become Iran's current president. So all of those infighting, all of those factionalization, all of those fraction is really coming to surface, and it's really tearing the regime apart from within. So I think if you look at some of those indicators, you really do see that the house of cards that Khamenei has set up, even with the facade and the image of the brutal and the solid power of the IRGC, it's really nothing but a house of cards. And it is not sustaining its facade in the light of ongoing protests and ongoing pressure. And I think one other point that I'd like to make in terms of how do we help the people of Iran, especially with Khamenei's rhetoric and the IRGC's image of having the tight control on Iran, is the international pressure.
Okay, you've written about that, and I read your latest article where you really feel that the U.S. is not doing what it should, that Washington has been kind of soft-pedaling support, and you feel that they should come out, you know, much stronger. And you mentioned end nuclear negotiations with Iran, expand and enforce existing U.S. sanctions, especially in light of the prison massacre, impose travel bans on regime officials and families, freeze their assets in the U.S. I thought that had already been done, quite frankly, but promote global campaign to close Iranian embassies and urge allies to recall their ambassadors and publicly press for the release of all political prisoners. I mean, in general, though, I mean, a lot of that seems to me that it has been done, has it not? I mean, obviously, ending nuclear negotiations is a much bigger step.
So I think what we are not hearing from the White House is a clear message that we stand with the Iranian people and recognize their right to overthrow this regime and to self-defense. The people of Iran deserve and reserve the right to overthrow this regime. What Washington like to hide behind is regime change is not our policy. That is not what the Iranian people are asking to bring boots on the ground to change the regime for us. Iranian people are in the streets chanting death to dictators. Young, old men, women are in the streets dying, sacrificing to bring this regime down. And they deserve the right to self-defense against the bullets of the IRGC and to overthrow this regime. That is a very clear public and a political statement that Washington can make that could really go a long, long way.
Why does that help? I mean, it seems symbolic to me. It just seems symbolic to me if you say, you know, make a statement that you support the people in the street. I mean, those statements to a degree have been made by various U.S. officials, including President Biden, was sympathetic over the weekend. But I mean, why did those statements really help the people in Iran who are out there fighting the Revolutionary Guard?
So there are two things. One is the statements have been made, but it hasn't been concise. For example, there has been a statement made that we stand with the Iranian women marching in the streets fighting for their rights. This is not a protest that women are fighting for their rights. This is a protest that is calling for the downfall of this regime. Let's be very clear on our message. Two, I think from the impact of Washington that could essentially lead to a global campaign to isolate the regime, just like the way the world community isolated the apartheid regime in South Africa, it would really have its more momentous and support in a public sphere where people of Iran essentially will gain the confidence that, yes, Iran is not, this regime is essentially rejected by the world community.
I mean, they're backing us. We've seen these demonstrations before, though, right? Now, you obviously feel that this is different this time, that this, the intensity, the length of time that they've been taking place, your measure of how exhausted Iranians are with the regime, how thirsty they are for change, that it's different this time. And that if the West doesn't seize this moment together with Iranians, they will have missed the chance to end this brutal regime in Iran. You really feel that the West has to seize this moment as well as the people in the street in Iran.
Absolutely, absolutely. And let me tell you why. If you look at during the 1980s, when there was massive uprising within 2 years of the 79 revolution, that led, you know, it was massive uprising by major opposition groups, among them Mujahideen-e-Khalq, the MEK, and then the establishment of the National Council of Resistance and the terrors and the executions that also led to the massacre of the 1988. Iranian regime was able to crack down and really suppress the society on two fronts, both on a political front, but also on a social front because of the Iran-Iraq war. During the 1990s, the regime turned into the terrorism in an international space and killing the opponents outside. But yet we still had massive student uprising inside Tehran's universities and other universities. Again, another crackdown. During the 2003, all the way to 2009, we had massive uprising, whether it was in the universities or it was in 2009, that was after the elections. That particular uprising started with, where is my vote? To down with Khamenei, down with dictatorship. And now what we look at in 2018, even in 2020 during the pandemic, and now in 2022, the length of these massive nationwide uprising is getting closer and closer, and the frequency is picking up. And the message is no longer over economic grievances or just social grievances. It's also political grievances. So it's all of the above. And the engagement of all of the social sectors, women, youth, labor movement, teachers union, student movement, it's all coming together. And I think this is why this time is different. Just a few days ago, I ran into a video clip by President Obama, who chose not to stand with the people of Iran in 2009, when people were in the streets towards the end saying, down with Khamenei, down with dictator. And he said, in retrospect, that was a mistake. In retrospect, we should have declared our solidarity. We should have been clear with our message. That is why this time is very, very important. And in fact, I think the international community owes it to their own respective national security to stand with the people of Iran that would end this regime. And the desire of the Iranian people is a non-nuclear, secular republic of Iran that stands on gender equality, freedom of press, fair and free elections, modern judicial system, coexistence with the neighbor, free market economy, all of those things in terms of a future-free Iran. It's also in the interest of the Middle East as a region, interest of the national security of America as a country, and also peace and stability and security for Europe. So there is, the moment is ripe, the situation is ripe, the people are in the streets, and that political support for the movement inside Iran and Iran's main opposition group, the National Council of Resistance of Iran, is critical in this moment, so that the Iranian regime understands the world international community is done with them and they're standing with the people of Iran.
Dr. Ramesh Sepharad, you're full of hope and you're very optimistic. And I think a lot of people find that, you know, perspective really important right now, because I think you're showing in a lot of ways that this is just not another uprising or chapter or more street protests, that we're in a very different chapter this time. So thank you so much for your perspective, and it's great to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
All right, and now to COVID. Eric Fagelding is an outspoken epidemiologist. Eric, I hope you don't mind that. Based in Washington, who has really been recently ringing alarm bells about COVID, ringing them again, and ringing them even now when a lot of people have forgotten about it. Hi, Eric.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell me, I am reading your tweets last week. Scoop, mother of God, just got this leak, which I want to talk about more, from the CDC insider source. It seems that COVID variants are worse than the CDC has been admitting. The new highly evasive BQ1 and BQ11 subvariants are surging over 11%, but the CDC has not shared it yet. You seem to be saying, first of all, that the Center for Disease Control is covering up information on a COVID surge that is just beginning. Is that fair?
Well, I didn't exactly say covering up. They've been very derelict and slow in reacting to the surging variants, because these BQ variants have been like on the radar of scientists for well over a month. Like, we gave them the name Typhon and Cerberus like over a month ago, because we knew these are two of the most highly evasive, immune escaping evasive variants that's been ever tested in the lab. And so we're really worried. And the fact that, you know, the CDC has a standing policy, internal policy of basically breaking out and declaring any variant that's surging above 1%. And the thing is, like, up until like Thursday, the CDC website had nothing about the BQs. It had nothing. And all of a sudden, the next day, it was at 11%. It didn't go from like 0 to 11% overnight. And they had to like backfill a whole 3 or 4 weeks that shows it was surging for 3 or 4 weeks.
All right. You didn't use the word cover up to be fair, but you did say, right. I cannot describe.
But it's just been very, very disappointing.
Let me read the tweet. I cannot describe just how mad I am at this disaster. The CDC seems to be holding on to this data. Can it be true? Why did this data have to leak to me from insider sources? It's so bad. I mean, you do seem to be saying that there is an intention to suppress information there. And again, that's my characterization.
I can't exactly express intention, but it's an extreme amount of disappointment. And there's an extreme amount of anger and emotion around what the hell, how the hell did this sneak up on us to go from not over 1%, but to 11% out of completely nothing in the prior weeks, right? And I think that's why the source, released it to me, because that person was very, very frustrated of how the hell did we get here? I'm basically told that, the CDC last week when asked, is there any BQ variants? They said, no, nothing here to see, nothing on the reports. And then all of a sudden, 11%. That doesn't happen. Just by pure accident, or that doesn't happen if people were competent, right? And this is where the sheer, we know that we're approaching this winter surge. We know there's dozens and dozens of variants out, and we know these two variants are two of the worst. I would say these are, of all of them, they're number two and number three of the all-time worst variants in terms of evasiveness. And we have been completely dropping the ball, and that's what's so frustrating.
Okay, let's get past the CDC process, which I think you already have, and talk about what should the CDC be doing, and which is obviously telling people as quickly and as openly as possible about this, and what result are you looking for out of that? I mean, you're saying that these variants are worse than any of the other ones that we've seen, and then what does that mean? Does that mean we're heading back means, to lockdowns people dying in hospitals?
I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is, first of all, these are so evasive that monoclonal antibody drugs, just according to lab studies, do not work against them. Even the FDA has warned that some of the monoclonal antibodies aren't working against these variants anymore, because these monoclonal antibodies were designed many, many years ago, a long time ago. And also for vaccines, it means that you need the new BA5 bivalent. Now, the BA5 bivalent is commonly available in the US and in Canada. They have both the BA1 bivalent and the BA5 bivalent because the BQ1 and BQ11s are subtypes of BA5. And the lab studies show that they're still sufficiently good, I think. But the BA5 bivalent is not available in the UK, if I understand correctly.
Tell me, what did I – and I hate to interrupt you, but you run through a lot of information really quickly because you know this stuff so well. And for us dummies, you got to slow down a little bit. So on October the 6th, just 2 weeks ago now, less than that, I got a booster here in London called Spikevax, Moderna Biotech, Spain. Is that the booster I'm supposed to be getting?
So the Moderna and Pfizer both make the original, the BA1 and the BA5. The UK, to my understanding, gives out the BA1 bivalent. It's an older bivalent. So it's an Omicron, but it's an older Omicron that's now extinct. The BA1 does not exist anymore.
I thought this was a newer booster.
Yes. The UK does not have the newest. The BA1 is a newer, but not the newest. And the issue is that there was a debate earlier this summer of we had done a lot of trials on the BA1 booster shot. So should we roll it out? It looked very good in the human trials. Should we roll it out? Or should we update it for the BA5 and then roll it out? UK decided to go ahead and roll out the BA1. And UK rolled it out ahead of the US. But US decided to wait another month and roll out the BA5 variant booster, which is the more dominant, common worldwide strain that's not extinct. BA1 is already extinct, and Fauci and others had made a tough decision, say, no, let's just hold off for one more month and develop the BA5 booster.
So what does my booster do for me?
So this is the open question. BA1 is a more older variant, not the oldest. It's not the oldest Wuhan. I'm not telling people not to get it, because I think getting that is better than, you know, not getting a booster at all. But I think the UK government needs to recognize that you need to give out the BA5. Like, Germany is now starting to roll out the BA5 soon, I believe. Canada is as well. US has been exclusively offering the BA5. US is also offering the BA5 bivalent to children now, 5 and up. So children now can get that booster 5 years and up. But in the UK, I understand that's still not available, not to mention boosters for kids. So I think UK is very behind the ball right now compared to many other countries. And BQs are subtypes of BA5 branch. So you need the BA5 to be adequately protected, I believe.
Now you tell me. I'm supposed to be interviewing you more often so I don't get needles.
If you put me in charge of UK vaccine response, I can, you know, shake up a few things here and there, but I can only do so much.
So here we are. I mean, this podcast talks to a lot of people all over the world. So there are different vaccines that are out there, some of them older, some of them newer. But, you know, here we are, like, that was the fourth needle I've had in my arm now, right? Because I had the vaccine, the first, the second, the booster, another booster. And now it looks like the booster I got isn't going to do much compared to the newer booster.
Well, it's going to protect you more. It will definitely protect you more. I mean, It's still in the Omicron
family.
How many
needles am I supposed to get? And people don't want to keep taking vaccines.
Well, first of all, flu shot. You're supposed to get a flu shot every year. And that's completely normal. Look, an ounce of prevention is a pound of cure. Don't say, oh, how many needles? Like, oh, why do I have to brush my teeth all the time? I just want to brush my teeth once and not have to do it again, right? No, that's not. It's a method of prevention. Oh, why do I have to exercise again? I just exercised last month. You know,
yeah, like, but this is putting something alien in my body, which I'm told is safe.
It's safe. And plus, by the way, you take pop multivitamins. You can say that popping multivitamins is alien. Like, if you want to make it scary sounding, you can, but it's not. It's not inherent.
No, I mean, I don't mean to because I do take the vaccines. And
there's antibiotics, all these ibuprofen, acetaminophen, paracetamol, like all these are, you know, foreign. These are drugs. And inherently, they're not always bad. And, you know, vaccines have been well tested. Flu vaccine, by the way, some people say that the new vaccine wasn't tested enough. There's this 8 mice rumor that's rooming around. The Omicron bivalent vaccines have been tested in thousands of people. It has been tested in thousands of people, including the one that you just took. So I think, you know, that is a very ridiculous claim. And it's the same update method as the flu. We see what variants are circulating with the flu each year. We update it and we roll it out to hundreds of millions of people. And again, children get shots. Children get booster shots. Tetanus, you have to get it once every 10 years, depending on the country. So, right. Like, these are completely normal. People shouldn't see it as, like, some, ugh, again. And hopefully we're developing nasal vaccines that will be much more effective against infection onset. Versus just the muscular vaccine that we are getting now. So that's on the horizon. And I think I have a lot of hope for these nasal vaccines. So I'm thinking, like, we're probably at halftime in terms of this pandemic. We have the initial, you know, defense set up, but to truly win the game, again, win this pandemic and stop it, we can't let up now. Because if you let up right before the race is over, you know, you're going to lose.
It's so important what you're saying, because a lot of people think it's kind of done. And you're saying we're at halftime. So what is the risk if we don't stay on top of it in the second half?
Well, the risk is that as you get infected more and more, you have higher and higher risk of adverse events of long COVID. that's just published recently in the latest studies. The more infections, you know, your symptoms of cardiovascular risk, your cognitive decline, it's higher with each additional infection that you have, that you recover from. And that's not something you want. You don't want to bioaccumulate more infections. Like, infection upon infection is not a thing you want. But at this rate in which we let the virus spread to hundreds of millions and billions of people, the virus will evolve more variants. And if you don't stop the transmission, if you just say, oh, we're stopping hospitalization, you know, which, by the way, UK hospitalizations are pretty damn high right now. And hospitals, NHS is pretty overloaded. And so is Germany, by the way. And Germany's ICU is like 90% capacity as well. You know, just saying, oh, you know, we just need to keep our hospitalizations down and deaths down, that is not a method of prevention whatsoever. Like, just because hospitals are not full, which they are actually right now, you don't say, oh, today drunken driving is okay. Today you don't need to wear a seatbelt. Today you don't need to wear a bike helmet. No, that's not how it works. You want to stop the onset of it in the first place. And unlike these seatbelt, you know, bike helmet examples, if the more you let it transmit, a virus is different because the more you let it transmit, the more it's going to evolve variants that will evade. And then you're going to, it's this arms race. You're going to further fall back on this arms race and then get infected more. The end of the pandemic is to reduce infections and transmission. And that's why combination of masks, which I know a lot of people don't want to wear it, but ventilation, air disinfection should be completely apolitical, right? It's not, you're not putting anything in your body. You're not putting something on your face. It is simply fresh air and disinfect and filter the air. It is not that hard. It is not that politically loaded. It is not behaviorally, onerous in any way. It should be the cornerstone. Yet we do not invest in these. But just like we should invest in bike helmets and bike lanes and other, you know, safety precautions that we have in everyday life, we somehow just this thing is way too inconvenient. We just, if it's too inconvenient, we're just going to have to like live with it. And living with COVID is really, really a horrible idea for society.
Last question to you. What kind of winter do you think is looming out there? Just not for the US, but for Europe and elsewhere.
Because it's not just COVID. We're going to get a double or triple whammy of COVID plus really bad flu plus RSV, as well as there's a new enterovirus going around as well. So I think it's going to be pretty bad because we know the flu season was really, really bad in Australia. The peak was much higher than ever recorded. It's also starting in Europe and North America much earlier than normal season. Normally, the flu season is December, late November, December. It's already at the same December level already now in October, and so that's what worries me. What the winter will bring. I think it's going to be a confluence of all these different things together that's going to bring a really tough winter, and I think workers, healthcare worker burnout and shortages is only going to further exacerbate waiting times and clinical care.
Governments won't do lockdowns. We won't go back to what the last.
I don't think they're going to do lockdowns. Well, there's before you do lockdowns, you know, lockdowns is like the last resort in which you shouldn't get there. If you have other mitigations in place, you don't need to do lockdowns. And you shouldn't have to. You should not have to do them. If you do all these other mitigations, right, like mental ventilation, air disinfection, masks, premium masks, and vaccines. Obviously, vaccines alone is not going to stop a transmission given all the variants. But if you multi-layer them together and do testing, contact tracing, you can stop the transmission off. But we're not doing them anymore. UK has stopped giving out free testing, right? Quarantine isolation, I believe, is kind of like a joke now. You know, we do not have masks in schools in many places still. And, ventilation
don't have masks. They don't have-
is a very privileged thing. Only if some principal, teachers, or parents are very aggressive in getting them installed in your local schools. But otherwise, you know, most schools don't have ventilation air disinfection.
A lot of people think because the vaccines have been given out that that's it and that they don't need to pay much attention to this anymore.
Yeah, I feel like people have a very short attention span. People hope that it's, this inconvenient thing, just do the bare minimum and move on. You know, this is how we kind of ignore climate change. Climate change is a clear and present danger. Oh, but it's in 50 years. Oh, it's in 100 years. Oh, it's not my current problem right now. And let's just sweep it under the rug. People too often have a sweep it under the rug attitude. And governments and leaders have show people that we're doing some stuff until the next election. We just need, you know, give perception that we're winning this COVID fight until the next election. And I think that's a very dishonest, disingenuous way of leading society.
Eric Fagelding, always great to talk to you, Eric. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Dana. Take care.
And that's our Backstory podcast this week. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Dr. Eric Fagelding and on Iran, Ramesh Sepharad. I'm Dana Lewis, and I'll talk to you again soon.